Radio for Women is on the air. Today's show is on women and athletics. Sports in the United States has always stood for many things. At its best, it has stood for strength and character. It has also meant that someone or something has encouraged and supported a child before they became an athlete to hold those values. To some, these skills have meant a chance to go to college and earn a living. To others, it was just doing something they loved to do. Simple enough, as long as you didn't have to worry about paying a coach, belonging to a country club, or having the leisure time to practice. Athletic strength has in general also meant maleness. Discouraging and excluding women has occurred through subtle and not so subtle tactics. Many athletes receive their most important training in college. Many of the tournaments, such as the Olympics, stipulate you must be an amateur. Up until this year, women lost amateur status by accepting an athletic scholarship. Men did not. Now, all a woman has to do is compete for one of the dozen or so scholarships available to her. Athletics is a field where one has to put in years of practice, money, and time into something that might get them recognition and probably won't bring in enough money to live on. If you are poor, the possibilities of an athletic career go down. If you are black, racism still stands in the way. And if you're a woman, you probably wouldn't even consider it. In this program, you will hear the stories and thoughts of several women in sports. Feminism and its ramification in athletics will also be explored.
See, it was different in my school because we had like junior varsity and varsity teams, and we played other schools in the district. And we had tryouts, of course, and like I played on varsity for 3 years, my sophomore through senior years, and most of the women who like started when I was a sophomore, you know, were the same age and the same grade. They kept on with basketball like I did, so we developed. You know, the team got better over like 2 or 3 years because you're working with the same women. You know, and you know them, and they know you, and you know what each other's capabilities are and how you perform. So we developed real close friendships, and I don't know, it was just really great. We used to go out and have slumber parties all the time, you know, the team, and we were like a clique in ourselves.
Well, we had basically the same setup you did, where we had varsity and junior varsity, like the men did. But the main difference was that the women's sports were in the afternoon, which was when everybody was tired after classes, and that's when our games were, and they were scheduled either away or home games. And sometimes we went to another school or stayed at our school. But very few people attended the women's games, and at some point somebody suggested to me it would have been a good idea if it had like the men's and women's varsity at night and junior varsity in the afternoon, so that the women would have been more, you know, it would have showed more importance to women's sports, but it didn't.
It would have been promoted in such a fact, you know?
Huh?
It would have been promoted.
Yeah, it would
went
have,
to a higher
it would have
status.
Shown, yeah, right.
People would
more
recognize
status to it. But it wasn't an important thing to most people in the. Most of the people who came to see women's games in the afternoon were the men's team, which was really the men's
yeah.
varsity team. And it was nice that we got some support from somewhere, but we didn't get too much support from women, which was a shame.
Oh, we at least had cheerleaders at Ballou. I went over at Ballou on 4th and Trenton. Yeah, that was a pretty nice school for a little while, you know. And they had a very good basketball team. And, you know, we had all the beautiful girls in Washington there, it seemed like. I mean, they were really beautiful, I got to admit. You know, I wasn't on the cheerleaders or anything. I was on the basketball team. We even had the prettiest ladies on there. And like that's how we got to be known, I think. We weren't known as everybody known as in all, you know, all over the city, but like people would, you know, stay after school and watch us play. You know, a group of people, maybe 40, maybe 50 people, you know.
Wow.
It's a pretty big school, the bleachers and everything. And we'd be down there, you know, playing games among ourselves, you know. And like she'll still be teaching us in a way, but we'll, you know, more or less she'd be sitting down talking to somebody, you know, trying to conduct, you know, but it was a beautiful time. You know, I wanted to stick with it, but after a while I got into running track and things like that.
I did that too.
Really?
Yeah.
Track?
Yeah, I didn't know you went to track.
Yeah, I went to track. Basketball was my biggest sport.
Yeah, me too.
But I just couldn't stay in it too long. I mean, you know, after you get out of high school and you go on, it's hard. You don't have many, you know, basketball teams out here. Like, they used to have baseball teams like the Rockettes, the post office over there in Lincoln Park, you know, in Washington. And now they don't have a basketball team. They still have those teams. They don't have a basketball team, you know, whereas people from all over the city can come and join. Women, you know, like 20, maybe 18 and over. You know, that was the age limit then. And they don't have women like that playing, you know, basketball. I think it would be a nice sport. I think people enjoy it, you know.
You know, each boy that played high school basketball was so much into his own ego.
He was Rudy Valentino, you know, of the school, you know. Oh, well, I go with the leader of the basketball team, you know, haha, this is big, you know.
Yeah, they weren't heroes as much. It was a lot more teamwork with women.
Yeah, with women it was a teamwork sort of thing. Hey, she's on my side, leave her alone. Hey, we've got to get them, you know, and it was just sticking together. I mean, I really like that sort of thing, you know. It was years ago, and I remember it in a nice way.
Yeah, it was a really nice experience. I was carried away with it. I thought about it. I dreamed about it. I laid in bed at night and couldn't sleep because I was dreaming up plays all the time.
Really?
Yeah, I loved it. I would sit in classes, and you know how you doodle on your books?
Mm-hmm.
I would, like, be drawing a little play.
The women who were on the team I was on in our school, we were pretty much all school leaders in other aspects. And, you know, we were in other clubs and, you know, just pretty much were running the school. And, like, I've heard other women who I've talked to about what it was like in their school, you know, saying that most of the women who played sports were really shunned by other people, and certainly boys wouldn't look at them because they were the, you know, the real shits of the school.
Yeah, we were a little bit eccentric, but everybody was coming from a lot of different places within the school. Like, it was one thing that brought a lot of the women in the school together, because the women on my team were coming from all the different backgrounds that were represented in the school. But basically, we were all a little bit eccentric, and we're on a sort of different level from other activities in the school, because it just wasn't something that women were encouraged to do.
In my school, the women were praised very highly, you know, on the basketball team. Really.
That's really true.
I'm not kidding. I mean, the men loved us just as much as the girls did, you know, really.
Yeah,
everybody,
well, the men appreciated us as basketball players,
well,
but not as dates or anything like that.
Well, they
know?
Appreciated us that way to a certain extent, because, like, the girls on the basketball team, well, most of them were also on the cheerleaders, you know.
Oh, really? It was
yeah,
the same
team.
Women?
And then some
the
of them were on the drill team, so they were all together, and the men sort of respected the cheerleaders, you know, because they made up, you know, the sayings to go with the team, you know. They made the spirits, the spirits, you know.
Well, that's a whole different way of thinking about cheerleaders, that's for sure. Because
yeah, but they look the same, you know, and like I don't know, we were all together. We looked all right, I assume.
That probably is because maybe you were more interested in sports in general, and it seems like a whole lot of the women in my school, like, who were really into sports, were the ones who were more into playing. And I know there were a lot of times I thought about becoming a cheerleader because I was athletic and I felt I could be a good cheerleader.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew I only had so much energy.
You go through it by the athletic view,
yeah,
right.
Every time I thought about becoming a cheerleader, I just realized that would take away from basketball, and I didn't want that, so I never did it. But there was a lot of motivation for becoming a cheerleader, too.
Denise Wong has been proclaimed the greatest female basketball player in the world. She has a lifetime average of 69.6 points per game and a high game of 111 points. She was drafted in the 13th round of the Men's National Basketball Association, the only female they ever drafted. Denise went to San Francisco and was placed on their women's team, where they proceeded to play each other intramurally all year. Needless to say, there was no real challenge involved. Denise was particularly disappointed to find that her home state of Iowa was unusual in their support of women's basketball. Their state finals had an excited crowd of 15,000 and was televised in 9 states. But in San Francisco, only a few parents showed up for the collegiate games.
Athletics is not something to be counted on as supporting yourself, especially if you're a woman. The Professional International Track Association for the first time allowed a women's event, the 60-yard dash, at their annual event. They were, however, paid equally with the men. $500 for first place, $250 for second place, $100 for third place, and $50 for fourth place. The Women's Demolition Derby, also held yearly, was in Long Island, New York, in 1972, where grand prize was $100. Amy Muchler, the only woman with a sponsor, won first place. Patty Gostello does somewhat better in bowling, where she won 5 out of 11 tournaments held by the Professional Women's Bowling Association and placed in 5 of the others. She has earned $30,000 in 3 years. Unfortunately, a man with the same success would have earned $200,000.
Cheryl Toussaint, Olympic track runner.
I started running track when I was about 13 years old, and I started making progress after about a year and a half or so, and I made the Olympic trials in 1968 when I was 15. I knew I had the talent, and I knew that if I worked hard enough for the next 4 years, that I would be able to make the 1972 Olympics. I think it's inspiring for the younger girls on the team. Well, they see me every day at the field, running, practicing, just like them, feeling the same pain that they feel. And of course, if I go on and do something that's outstanding and that's considered very good, I think that they feel at that point that they're capable of doing the same thing. It's believable, it's possible, they can go out and do it.
Robin Smith, licensed jockey.
There are more and more women on the track now than there certainly even 2 years ago. And they're very valuable in the morning, as trainers put it, but they don't think they can ride in the afternoon. They're dedicated and they love what they're doing and they're patient with horses in the morning. So that way, I can see where there'll be probably more women on the racetrack than men. Well, I had started in riding, I guess you would say, by just being interested in the races. And I would say the first year of riding, I just paid $2.50 an hour, you know, at the riding stable. And then shortly after, I went to the racetrack and got a job galloping horses. The first girl got her license, which I had really never thought of. I thought it'd be great to be a jockey, but I didn't think a woman would ever stand a chance in getting a license. So the timing was really pretty good. I got my license at Golden Gate Field, which is in San Francisco, and I rode around the fairs, which is pretty tough riding. I decided that's really not for me, because it can get pretty rough around the fairs. And if I were going to pursue this business, I would like to try and go first class, so I gave New York a shot. This will be my 4th year of riding as a regular, of riding period since I started. And each year I ride more horses, so that's a little encouraging. So I'm light, I'm strong, and true, I'm not as strong as a male jockey, but I don't need that extra amount of strength that, say, a man has over me, because it's finesse with a horse, it's communication, it's using your head. I have all the strength that I need to win races and compete with the jockeys that I'm competing with. I do have the ability to win on horses. All I have to get now is the opportunity, you know, to ride good horses. When I get them, I win. When I don't win, just like any other jockey.
The women's Japanese volleyball team recently completed a tour of several cities in the United States, playing exhibition games against the USA women's team. In Los Angeles, the match was not covered by any of that city's newspapers, and only one TV station even mentioned the event.
Judy Lilly is the top super stock drag racer in the United States. She won the 1972 Winter Nationals and set the national record of 10.30 seconds and 135.38 miles per hour. A reasonable amount of money for a racer to pull in a year is $20,000. However, Judy spent $6,000 for her car and put $32,000 into it in a few years. Because she's a woman, it took her 3.5 years to find a sponsor to kick in $300 a year. She was a hairstylist and presently doing secretarial work to live on. In her own words, I've been racing 12 years now, and I've only started to win big in the last 2 of them.
The following is a discussion with Alice McAdam, a gymnast with the University of Florida and a member of the NOW, National Task Force on Women and Sports. Alice, do you want to tell us about the gymnastics team at the University of Florida?
This year, for the first time, the Intercollegiate Athletic Association funded varsity athletics for women, funded five teams in gymnastics, swimming, golf, tennis, track and field. And the women have made an outstanding debut. They're one of the first schools in the country to have such a varsity athletics program, and probably the first in the Southeast. And we finally have the commitment on the part of the Women's Physical Education Department to continue with such a program, so that it's not just a hit or miss thing now, it's a sure thing. When a coach leaves, another one will be found to replace that person. We're going to expand as soon as we can, as soon as we find people and facilities. That's the biggest problem, is getting space and facilities to include other sports such as softball and volleyball, things like that. So it's expanding.
And where are you competing now, or are you?
We compete throughout the winter, mostly with schools in the Southeast, Georgia Southern, Georgia College for women, Furman University. We may get as far up as North Carolina, South Carolina this year, and some schools from Mississippi and Louisiana. There are schools all around the country with competition in gymnastics. Some of the finest is in California and up in the Northeast with Springfield College and Penn State, schools like that.
Alice, why are you competing in gymnastics?
Well, I've been interested in gymnastics a long time. I've taken part in it since I was very young, but I've never had the opportunity to compete. And I've come close to giving it up several times. At age 16, I was really over the hill. But I've decided I have an opportunity, and I want to ensure the opportunity that the women after me, I want to ensure that they have the opportunity to compete. So I'm competing now, and I'm determined that I'm going to continue, I'm going to stay in shape. And some of the benefits that are provided to me by being on the team just are not available to me throughout the whole university. There is really a great feeling of sisterhood on the team that I really enjoy. It's a group that I can go and I can work with, and we have to trust one another physically, because if we don't, we fall. If you don't trust yourself that you can do it, you're going to fall. And if you fall, you have to trust that your spotter is going to catch you, or you're going to make it even worse on yourself. So it's really kind of exciting to see somebody else go out on the mat to do her free exercise routine, and the whole team kind of throws their arms to the side when she tries her difficult trick, hoping she'll make it, and they close their eyes when she does the hard one that she's liable to fall on. And when she's done, they know she's done a good job. And when she's done a bad job, they can tell her precisely what she did wrong, but they can also tell her what she did right, like nobody else can. So it's a really good together, supportive kind of feeling that isn't just all tied up with competition. Not too many of us are really concerned when we get out there, how can we beat this other team, da-da-da-da. But if you hadn't fallen off the beam, that would have been, our 5/10 of a point. It comes down to individual responsibilities and the commitment that, well, she's going to do better next time because I'm going to work with her and make sure she gets that trick, instead of, blaming it on the sky or the other team or getting mad at them.
What are the possibilities, for a woman who's in gymnastics or any other collegiate sport to further it after school?
It's awfully difficult. This is one of the reasons I think intercollegiate athletics is fine. Unless you're at an extremely high level of ability, by the time you graduate from high school, that will probably be the end of your relationship with competition and athletics. It aren't many programs at the college level. And for the woman who is highly skilled, there are no colleges that will permit her to combine her competition with an education, so she stays out of the educational system. So it's a very frustrating system. There's no system of professional gymnastics for women to go into when they graduate. They may coach, but finding competition possibilities at their level of competition would be extremely difficult. At my own level of ability, it's difficult finding competition. You're either high level and you scoot all over the country for national level competition, or you're a 6-year-old who goes into little local AAU and Junior Olympic meets, or you sit somewhere in the middle and you rot. You don't get to compete. And that, what competition does for you in gymnastics is it makes you perfect your own skills. into a discernible pattern. You're not just throwing one trick after another, but they have to go together and you have to be able to do it as one whole unit. That's the difference between just participating and competing.
What about, you were talking about at the University of Florida, you have funding. What are other schools in the country doing as far as funding for women's teams?
Well, the situation is about to change drastically. Rollins College took a case to court and won the case that will now allow women to receive athletic scholarships and continue to compete. The Association for Intercollegiate Athletics for Women, until this time, has had a rule that said any woman who receives a scholarship for athletics or scholastics will not be permitted to compete. And so schools have either unofficially given scholarships, which hasn't occurred in too many cases, or they've given none. Now, University of Miami, come this fall, there will be 15 scholarships for women in athletics, 5 for golf, 5 for swimming, and 5 for tennis. Rollins College will continue to give some scholarships. I'm sure that some of the colleges up in the Northeast, California, and a few in the Midwest will be more than happy and ready and willing to give scholarships. At our school, I don't even know if we will get some of the supportive kind of services that go along with scholarships. Sometimes you don't give an athlete a scholarship, but if they come from out of state, you'll give them a tuition waiver that they pay regular in-state tuition instead of out-state tuition. I don't even know if we'll get that at my school, but that's about to happen at a lot of schools.
What are your plans after you get out of school?
Well, immediately I'm hoping to go to graduate school. I should have another year of eligibility and hope to continue to compete for 1 year. I'd like to get through graduate school and go into the public schools. I think a physical education program based on the needs of women, based on what they're interested in, and making them realize that this has an important value for them throughout their lives rather than, come on girls, get out there and play basketball, is important, and that needs to be strongly incorporated in the program. We do it now without ever telling them why or asking them why they should be doing it. I'd like to work in public schools for several years, perhaps in a school where I can coach gymnastics, but eventually I'd like to move back up to the college level where I can coach for sure and I can teach. I'm very interested in teaching self-defense, and I'd like to be able to teach at the college level where I can teach physical education majors themselves how to teach self-defense, which means it reaches a lot more people. And I found some acceptance of the theory of teaching self-defense in the physical education program. I've met some physical education instructors who are teaching it, and their students really enjoy it, and they've devised some good programs for teaching it, and it seems to be going quite well in public schools.
A 6-week self-defense class for women is available in Washington, which meets one night a week. Sue Lennertz and Marie Curry are the instructors. In their own words, they describe the course.
Well, the fact that women are getting raped all the time, women of any age, any place, any race, any class. Generally, we find that women are brought up not to be physically aggressive. They're not taught how to fight as children, whereas men, as children, are taught to fight. They are taught to defend themselves and to be able to be aggressive in physical situations. Now, when children grow up, the score is definitely uneven. Women are at the disadvantage. They have to go through special training just to learn how to survive day to day, to be able to stay at home, walk the streets, rape happens everywhere, without, you know, just insurmountable fear.
Do you have to be athletic to learn how to defend yourself?
No, not at all. We do like to stress that women should be in shape, should take pride in their bodies, in their strength. However, at least the techniques we teach are very basic. need very little practice to master them, very little physical strength or agility. I know that before I started taking self-defense, I never did anything athletic. I didn't suffer for it, except for the first few times after I exercised. But on the whole, the techniques are easy to master if you haven't, you know, been keeping up with any athletic exercise.
We feel that a woman, after taking the course, will be able to defend herself for several reasons. First of all, we offer the psychological approach to the problem that women are being raped, you know, presenting it as a political problem that, you know, one half of the population is not trained to be strong and the other half is. And secondly, we offer simple, direct, powerful techniques that don't depend on brute force, that, you know, the woman's smaller size is usually a disadvantage. We teach techniques that can be handled by a smaller person. Yeah, the basis of the course is a mastery of the strong points of the body against the weak points of the attacker's body. And by learning this, a woman, a very small woman, can defend herself against a very large man by knowing these, you know, these vital points, the weak points, and by attacking them with a strong point. We emphasize that throughout the 6 weeks. And, you know, this knowledge, as well as the psychological knowledge that women are not defenseless, is, you know, we feel adequate for a woman to not be raped, for her to get away if she's attacked on the street.
You know, the surprise element's very important also. Rapists on the street are expecting passive victims. They're expecting women not to fight back. When a woman does resist, she has an advantage insofar as her attacker is not expecting her resistance.
It's been our experience. We've been teaching this course for about a year. It's been our experience that the self-help approach, in other words, women who have the skills, sharing them with other women, that this is, you know, what we call a self-help approach. We feel that this has been very effective because, you know, like, there's an atmosphere of support and encouragement rather than competition. And, you know, this is another one of these socialization factors. Women are not socialized to compete the way men are, and often competition is detrimental. So, like, in the beginning, when a woman is just learning self-defense, she needs a whole lot of support, and we provide that, and so it's very helpful.
And what we teach is called Beginning Self-Defense for Women, and it's, you know, a basic elementary course.
We do this because we realize that, you know, so many women, because of jobs, housewife obligations, you know, the situations that we women find ourselves in don't permit a woman to devote full-time energy and commitment to learning the martial arts. And that's what it takes to learn karate. You know, I spend, you know, hours every day working out to learn karate, and that's what it takes. And we don't discourage women from doing this. In fact, we think it's very important that more women get into it. Right now, it's predominantly a male, well, sport, I guess you'd call it. And we want more women to get into it, you know, and put the commitment into it. But since women can't, we offer this course. And as far as, you know, a woman who would want to know about it, we would recommend the schools that are in this area, you know, to get the discipline and to study it. And it's, you know, it's very beneficial. The difference between karate and self-defense is that, you know, karate is an art form. It involves the whole philosophy and history and, you know, discipline. You have to commit yourself. And learning self-defense is a matter of just, you know, learning basic techniques and practicing them, and, you know, it can be done in 6 weeks, I believe it.
If you are interested in self-defense or would like a self-defense demonstration at your workplace, community center, or school, call the RIT Crisis Center at 333-RAPE.
The only women's event allowed in the Rodeo Cowboys Association rodeos is barrel racing. That is one of the reasons why the Girls Rodeo Association was established. The events included in Girls Rodeo Association rodeos are bareback riding, bull riding,
steer undecorating and breakaway calf roping.
Carrie Clyde, a professional motocross racer, won a court suit in 1971 against the American Motorcycle Association, forcing them to allow women racers to obtain licenses.
Maybe, for example, sports, you just cover that quickly, but, like, even if a girl had a chance of getting a scholarship, like, the equipment is so rotten because boys always have the priority. You know, you can practice on the track.
Definitely.
If the boys are finished, if the boys do not need to use it that day. It mm-hmm. always depends on if the boys don't need it. Then, second, mm-hmm. the girls have a chance to use mm-hmm. it.
Yeah, when mm-hmm. they built on the new gym in the school, they gave the girls the old gym and gave
uh-huh.
the boys the new gym.
Yeah.
And me, I'm a cheerleader, and it makes a lot of difference because, well, cheerleaders go to football games, you know. And who's ever heard about girls' hockey in the school, you know, pep rallies? Well, it's changing more and more this year, but every year before, our pep rallies have always been just a big boy sport, you know, football, basketball, baseball, sometimes soccer, sometimes wrestling, some, you know, a couple of others, maybe track. But never before this year has there been anything at all for the girls' sports. This year, just more, we're beginning to give a tiny bit more attention to it.
What's the general response to things like supporting girls' sports and girls' teams and things like that?
Well, it's taking a long time for anybody to accept it because they've been having trouble accepting all of the minor boys team. Like, I mean, most people say boys' tennis, so, you know, just the same response as maybe girls' hockey or girls' tennis or girls' track. I mean, there's just no interest, right, because
there isn't even that much discussion of it because, you know, nobody really takes it seriously. You never hear a guy saying, oh, wow, big threat, you know, or anything. Nobody really takes it seriously.
Well, I think it's also people that are in the sport are in it for different reasons than the male, the boys are, because I think girls in girls' sports are in it because they like to do it and they enjoy it. And I think a lot of the boys are in the sport because of the response it gets them.
Prestige,
especially for a mm-hmm. football team. Because with our state champion football team, wow, if you have a leather jacket with a patch on it, you can walk around at other schools and say, hey, look at me, you know, this whole bit. And it's almost funny. I'm just getting sick of seeing it.
Do you feel like you have any control over any of that? Or do you feel like you have any control over whether or not, you know, a girls' team wants to use the track and wants priority time, you know, doesn't want to come at 6 o'clock and doesn't want to stay till 8 to use that equipment?
Right now they're both using it at the same time.
Yeah.
And the girls have been running with the boys.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the one girl, Kim Peterson, who she ran on the boys' cross-country team this year. And I think she was on the indoor track team also, and I don't know whether she's going to be on girls. I imagine she'll be on girls' track this season. But she's really did well. I mean, she was winning JV, and she's only a sophomore.
Mm-hmm.
And that'd be good for any sophomore boy to do. And especially good for a girl. I'm really proud of her. I think that's quite an accomplishment, really.
In 1932, Employers Casualty Insurance Company of Dallas, Texas, sent Babe Zaharis to represent a one-woman team in track at the Olympics. She won the entire meet at the tryouts. In the Olympics, an individual is only allowed to enter three events, and Babe chose and won gold medals for the javelin throw and hurdles, and won the silver medal in the high jump. After the heroine's welcome home had worn thin, Babe Zaharis found herself in a typical situation for an athlete without money or other skills. She had tried entertaining club audiences with a singing sports demonstration act. Eventually, Babe started up with golf. She was very good at it, but you had to be an amateur to enter the big tournament, a standing which she lost as a result of the club act. In order to regain an amateur standing, Babe decided to stay out of professionalism for the required 3 years, which was a difficult task for her. Once back in competition, Babe Zaharis was the number one
woman golf player in the world in 1945 through 1947. She was named Woman Athlete of the Year for the second time. Still unsatisfied with the limited choices women had in golf to participate in the big tournaments, which were for amateurs, or to earn money only at exhibitions, Babe started the first women's professional tournament circuit, the Ladies Professional Golf Association, which for the first time enabled women to make a living at their profession. Today, the Babe Diedrichson Zaharis Trophy goes to the Associated Press Female Athlete of the Year.
Melissa Belote, gold medal winner in the 1972 Olympics for the 100, 200, and 400 meter backstroke relays in swimming.
How did you get started in swimming?
Well, in Northern Virginia, there are small community pools around, and we belong to one of these small community pools, Springfield Swim and Racquet Club. And all my friends, when they were 8 years old, were on this team, and they'd come on home on Saturdays, and they'd have these blue ribbons and red ribbons and white ribbons, and they'd say what fun they had and everything. And so it just got me interested. So they asked me, you know, why don't you join the team? So I joined the team and started swimming.
How old were you?
I was 8.
You must do a lot of practice
then. Well, pretty much so, yeah. Do a lot. Not compared to the West Coast swimmers. The West Coast swimmers do a lot more. We can't get pool time. We don't own a pool of our own, solitary swim team. We have to rent pools in the area. Mm-hmm. So I go an hour before school, an hour and after school, and 2.5 hours on the weekend.
Do you foresee going into the next
Olympics? All I look forward to is the upcoming nationals. So right now the farthest I'm looking is to April. Mm-hmm. And after April comes, then I'll look forward to the next nationals, which is in August. So you only take it season by season.
Oh, I see. Well, does that mean that, like, if you win the nationals, that you qualify to go to the Olympics? How does that work? I don't understand.
Well, the year of the Olympics, they have Olympic qualifying meets all through the United States. And you swim in one of these, and you swim times that will qualify you for the Olympic trials. Like, at a particular time, let's say the 200 backstroke qualifying times are 2:32. And anybody who swims faster than 2:32 can participate in the Olympic trials in the 200 backstroke. And when you get to the Olympic trials, you swim the trials in the morning, and which is usually anywhere from 3 to 5 heats with 8 lanes. So it's anywhere from 24 to 40 swimmers. Mm-hmm. And then after the trials, they take the top 8 time-wise. And the top 8 swims finals that night. And automatically the first person gets to go to the Olympics, and the second person automatically gets to go. Now, in order to take a third person, they go on a double system, which is, it's pretty complicated. What they do is, like, say, for instance, Shirley Babashoff, she wins 100 free and then wins the 200 free. Therefore, she's made the Olympic team twice. Mm-hmm. So therefore, it opens up a spot for another swimmer to make it. Mm-hmm. So in order to get, you know, the third swimmer or fourth swimmer, they do it by doubles. Mm-hmm.
Do you know if any schools offer, any colleges and universities offer scholarships for women in swimming?
Well, just recently now, a lot of colleges are beginning to give scholarships. The University of Miami is giving 4 swimming scholarships a year in swimming, and there's 6 other scholarships they're giving in various sports. I don't know how they break them up, maybe track and field and gymnastics or something like that, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. And then the University of Chicago gives scholarships, University of New Mexico, and I think Arizona State, but I'm not sure. And it's just more and more colleges are opening up now with women's scholarships.
Sounds like you've looked into that.
Yeah. Well, it really costs a lot to really be in any one sport. And, like, swimming, I guess, is one of the most expensive sports, I guess you could say, because you've got to rent a pool or you have to own a pool, you've got to pay a coach or somebody's got to pay a coach. And we have about 350 to 375 kids on our team, working out 4 different pools, as I said before. And we have 3 or 4 or 5 coaches, and 1 main coach who coaches only at my pool, and then we have his assistants coaching at the other pools. And, like, it's $22.50 a month, I believe. And this is for if you have 1 person on the team from your family. Then as you have, like, maybe 3 or 4 swimmers on the team in a family, the price, you know, varies according to how many swimmers you have. And really, I guess sometimes, like, you have to join a club. If it's a club, you have to join the club first in order to be on the team. You have to pay dues to the club, and then you have to pay the coach again also. And then, like, we don't have a sponsor, team sponsor, and so therefore my parents have to pay my way to meets back and forth, my hotel expenses, my entry fees. Well, when I was 10, I guess I was just like anybody, you know, just kind of help swimming around, getting the strokes fixed up, and trying to find out. When I first started, I was a butterfly. Now I can't stand butterflies. But I was a butterfly, and gradually, as I got older, you know, I guess it's everybody's dream for a little kid to, man, go to the Olympics. Wow, you know, everybody's dream in some sport. And so as I got older, I made the nationals when I was 12 years old. And back then, 12 was the youngest age you could make nationals. This was a senior nationals. I'm like, when I went, I saw names, you know, like Susie Atwood and Debbie Meyer and Rex Fitz and Mike Stam and Don Solander and all those names. And they just, you know, they just scared you. And to think, you know, that I'd ever be at that level was unbelievable. So I swam the nationals, and I got second to last that year. But I was young, and my coach thought that, well, that's a team experience, just being in there swimming, having to, you know, see the big names and everything. And so the experience helped, because when it did get time for the Olympics or the Olympic trials, it, you know, it didn't bother me at all. Being able to swim next to names. I went into the Olympic trials, either first in the 200 back and fourth in the 100 back. And so it's experience. And so really, I guess when I was 10 and 11, all I did was just kind of swim around like everybody else. And then when I was 12, I decided, you know, you might be able to go somewhere. So I started working. I started trying to put more and more into what I was doing every day.
Not quite as famous as Jackie Robinson, Althea Gibson was the first black tennis player to compete with whites. In 1948, and several years thereafter, she won the National Negro Women's Singles Championship. Alice Marble, one of the top players in the Women's Lawn Tennis Association, made charges of racism, which led to desegregation in 1950. In 1957 and 1958, Althea won the two top tournaments in the world, Wimbledon and Forest Hills. Concerned with making a living, Althea turned to golf, which had more opportunities at the time for women. She did well, but eventually returned to tennis as the pro in a New York club. Aside from breaking up the lily whiteness of tennis, token as it was, Althea Gibson also introduced a tough and aggressive style, never before practiced by women tennis players, who were very concerned with never losing their ladylike poise.